Hi, and welcome to Lakeshore Update. I'm Dee Dotson. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear the latest on the City of Gary mayoral candidates debate. U.S. Senator Richard Lugar is honored in Indianapolis. Brandon Smith reports on the state's next two-year budget. And Chris Nolte has a conversation with Brian Lamb, architect behind C-SPAN. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson defended her administration against political opponents who were on the attack in the first of several mayoral debates. Lake County Assessor Jerome Prince took her to task for, quote, waste and mismanagement. Candidate Carl Jones said, quote, I'm not satisfied with the status quo. The people's needs are not being met. Freeman Wilson, who is seeking her third four-year term as boss of City Hall, responded to her critics that she was the most qualified. She says, quote, education matters. Experience matters. Voters got their first chance Tuesday night to pick a favorite among the many candidates for Gary mayor. Six of the nine Democrats contesting the May 7th mayoral primary gathered at the Genesis Convention Center to discuss Gary's public safety and urban blight challenges. The League of Women Voters of Calumet Area hosted the event. Times local news editor Mark Chase, Michael Puente, Northwest Indiana reporter for Chicago's WBEZ Public Radio, Chris Nolte, host of Lakeshore Public Radio's Regionally Speaking, and Barb Hargrove, a member of the League of Women Voters, delivered most of the questions to the candidates. Some of the questions came from the audience of more than 100. Freeman Wilson, a Harvard University graduate who previously served as Gary City Judge and Indiana Attorney General, became the city's first black female mayor in 2011 and was re-elected in 2015. She is opposed by Lake County Assessor Jerome Prince, City Councilwoman LaVita Sparks-Wade, Mildred Tiny Elkhorn, Kerry Rice Sr., Carl Dozy Jones, Eddie Tarver Jr., Joe L. White, and James Cermak G.I. Edward McKnight. Rice, White, and McKnight weren't at Tuesday's event. All six candidates expressed support for legislation to replace Gary's floating casino with a land-based one now being planned along the Interstate 94 corridor. Prince questioned whether the interstate location is the best. Sparks-Wade cautioned Gary shouldn't view the new casino as a fix for all of Gary's ills. Freeman Wilson said the plan is to diversify Gary's economy by developing the current casino location at Buffington Harbor as a new logistics and transportation hub. Jones would prefer a voter referendum to decide a new casino location. Freeman Wilson said the city administration cannot be blamed for only 39% collection rate of the city's property tax collection since thousands of properties are without legal owners. Opponents like Prince argued it could be remedied by the city giving away derelict properties it holds to new homeowners. The mayor said such a program is already in place. You can tune into Lakeshore Public Radio next Tuesday, May 7th during the noon hour to hear the entire debate.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The Lake County Sheriff has barred a monitor ankle bracelet company and its employees from entering Lake County Jail after detainees' escapes were reported too late. Following an escape of a detainee who led police on a chase that injured three and another detainee who allegedly kidnapped and attempted to kill a relative of a witness from a 2017 attempted murder case, Lake County Sheriff Oscar Martinez said the monitoring company has been barred in the interest of public safety. Both detainees were criminal defendants who were wearing GPS ankle bracelets monitored by ICU Monitoring, Inc. and were on court-supervised release. On Monday, Martinez wrote a letter that prevented ICU Monitoring, Inc. staff from entering the county jail and also suspended new inmate applications for ICU monitoring until further notice. The letter, signed by Martinez and distributed to the Criminal Justice Coordinating Committee, Lake County Judges, Lake County Commissioners, Lake County Council, President of ICU Herb Smith, Lake County Police Chief William Patterson, and attorneys, outlined the investigation of both escapes.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Indiana Governor Eric Holcomb on Tuesday appointed Hammond's city attorney, Christina Cantar, to fill a judicial vacancy on the Lake County Superior Court Civil Division. Cantar was one of three finalists to replace Judge Diane Schneider, who retired in February. The appointment marks a moment of bipartisan agreement between the governor's office and Hammond Democrats, particularly Mayor Thomas McDermott Jr. The Times reports Cantar is a key ally of McDermott, who is widely seen as a political challenger to unseat Holcomb from the governor's office. The Times reports Cantar is a key ally of McDermott, who is widely seen as a potential challenger to unseat Holcomb from the governor's office. Cantar was appointed over fellow finalists Kristen D. Hill and Adam Sadia, who was favored by region Republicans. Of the three, Cantar earned the highest rating from the Lake County Bar Association. Sadia's candidacy came under scrutiny in recent days as posts attributed to his now-deleted Facebook page circulated among public officials. Some civic groups in the region called the post racially and religiously insensitive. Before becoming Hammond City Attorney, Cantar was twice a judge of the Lake Station City Court.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Members of the South Shore Line's governing board were surprised and some were deeply disappointed to learn last week they were to be replaced. The Post-Tribune reports, neither the Northern Indiana Commuter Transportation District Board members nor legislators had known that would happen until about a day before the Indiana General Assembly voted on the state budget bill, which includes the NICTI board change. The new state budget, signed Monday by Governor Eric Holcomb, increases the state support for improving and expanding the South Shore Line, Northwest Indiana's rail link to Chicago. It also reduces the NICTI board from 11 members to 5 and puts it under the control of the governor, who will make all the board appointments. 8 of the previous board members were appointed by the 4 Indiana counties served by the South Shore, and the governor had 3 appointments. The chief executives of the South Shore Line in NICTI have expressed gratitude to the state for budgeting $205 million on top of about $360 million pledged in earlier legislative sessions towards the South Shore's planned Westlake Corridor expansion and its double-track project. The governor's press secretary said the board change took place officially when the budget bill was signed on Monday. Holcomb said he would appoint a new NICTI board soon.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Dozens of Indianapolis political and civic leaders joined a tribute for former U.S. Senator Richard Lugar outside the building where he served as the city's mayor before winning the first of his 6 Senate terms. Democratic Mayor Joe Hogsett called Lugar an American statesman during Monday's ceremony, a day after he died at age 87. Hogsett and Republican Governor Eric Holcomb placed a memorial wreath beside the sign for the Richard G. Lugar Plaza next to the city county building. Flags nearby were at half staff as directed by Holcomb to honor Lugar until the day of his funeral. Lugar was a Republican foreign policy expert who helped spur the dismantling of thousands of former Soviet nuclear weapons. He served in the Senate from 1977 until 2013.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Governor Eric Holcomb signed the state's next 2-year budget into law Monday. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports Holcomb defended how Republican budget writers prioritized the state's dollars.
Holcomb's fiscal team and legislative leaders said throughout the budget writing process they were comfortable with the state keeping a little less than $2 billion in reserve. But the budget holds back a couple $100 million more than that in the state's coffers instead of spending it. Holcomb says that's prudent.
If, in fact, there is a downturn, we're in great shape to be able to respond.
One of the places lawmakers allocated less than originally planned is the Department of Child Services, which got $70 million fewer dollars than initially requested. Holcomb says the final number is adequate as the agency shows progress.
And if we get into a fix, I will do what I did last time, and we will make sure that DCS is fully funded should those numbers take a turn.
Holcomb previously shifted one-time dollars to the agency amidst a surge in cases. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Governor Eric Holcomb defended signing into law an anti-abortion measure that's been struck down in other states. The bill largely bans the second trimester procedure known as dilation and evacuation abortions. The ACLU of Indiana has already filed a lawsuit seeking to strike down the legislation. Holcomb says the threat of a lawsuit didn't factor into his decision to sign the bill into law.
The bills that I have signed have been out of my own conscience.
The ACLU has already scored victories in six other lawsuits against Indiana anti-abortion measures this decade at taxpayers' expense. And Democratic Senator Mark Stoops says that record shows Republicans' continued push to curtail abortion rights is not only, in his view, dangerous to women, but also fiscally irresponsible.
But I guess not all is lost. At least the ACLU will continue to receive funding to protect our rights.
Indiana has paid out millions of dollars to the ACLU in the last few years because of those abortion lawsuits.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A disciplinary case against Attorney General Curtis Hill will move forward as the state Supreme Court appointed a hearing officer Monday. The complaint against Hill comes out of accusations last year that he inappropriately touched four women, including a state lawmaker, at a post-legislative session party. Hill's attorney had argued the Disciplinary Commission complaint was unfounded and threatened to breach the separation of powers. He urged the Supreme Court not to appoint a hearing officer in the case, but the court rejected their request by appointing Myra Selby to hear the complaint. Selby, now an attorney in private practice, was the first African American and first woman to sit on the state Supreme Court.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Infighting between two top National Rifle Association leaders took center stage Saturday at the organization's membership meeting in Indianapolis. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton reports, those in attendance want transparency into the issues.
Then NRA President Oliver North was not at the meeting and instead had the group's first vice president read his letter announcing that he was stepping down and would not seek a second term. This came after reports that North tried to oust Chief Executive Officer Wayne LaPierre from his position. The leadership in attendance avoided addressing internal issues, including the lawsuit the NRA has against its longtime ad agency, Ackerman McQueen. Member Ron Carter from Colorado took the opportunity during new business to ask for answers.
The misuse of funds that has been going to Ackerman McQueen with no, absolutely no checks and balances is incredibly important to me.
The NRA is the largest gun rights advocacy group in the United States with about 5 million members, according to the organization. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Samantha Horton.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The annual National Rifle Association's conference in Indianapolis featured 15 acres of guns and gear. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton reports, gun manufacturers say it's an important tool for their business.
For gun enthusiasts, the expo center was filled with a wide variety of rifles and gear for attendees to pick up and look at. Cooper Firearms of Montana is a custom rifle manufacturer. Sales associate Brandon Bowe says meeting with potential customers at the convention is an important part of the company's business.
This industry and buying a firearm, you have a personal attachment to that product that you're purchasing. And here we can build relationships with customers and people can put a face to the name.
About 75,000 people were expected to be at the convention over its 3 days. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Samantha Horton.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Governor Eric Holcomb signed a career and technical education bill into law on Tuesday at a high school manufacturing center in Seymour. The law gives the governor's workforce cabinet control of $50 million of federal education funding and lets school districts hire career and technical education instructors with formal teaching licenses. It also creates a grant for career coaching and a program called Let Indiana Work for You, aimed at keeping college graduates in Indiana. The law is set to go into effect on July 1st.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Hundreds of Hoosiers, including some of the state's political elite from both parties, gathered Wednesday for a memorial to former Senator Birch Bayh, who passed away a few weeks ago. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports on the State House service for the Indiana Icon.
Birch Bayh's son, Evan, who holds his own notable place in Indiana political history, talked about his father's legacy, from authoring two constitutional amendments to helping craft the anti-discrimination language of Title IX.
Of course he was an idealist. Of course he was a dreamer. But he was also a pragmatist. And as one or two of the previous speakers have noted, he was a doer.
Christopher Bayh talked about his father's personal side and called him an incredible fountain of love.
I want to share with you the joy he had for life, whistling gospel tunes or Sousa marches, singing aloud to Hank Williams or the Statler Brothers when no music was playing.
There were also a few moments set aside for the passing of another Hoosier political legend, Richard Lugar, who died earlier this week. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Early this spring, parts of the Midwest saw record flooding. With climate change, Indiana's winters and springs are only going to get wetter. The Purdue Climate Change Research Center says by the middle of this century, we could see up to 20% more rain in those seasons, likely leading to more flooding. But as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel reports, like many people living in Midwestern states, few Hoosiers have flood insurance.
Deb Guffey has had enough. She and her husband Ray own Brown County Tire and Auto Service in Nashville. This February marked the third time their shop has flooded in the past 10 years. Outside, employees tried to lift a customer's car out of the water and onto a tow truck. Inside, Guffey says the water in her office was more than 4 feet deep.
It came so fast. We tried to unplug what we could, and my secretary and I, Jessica, got shocked. And so finally, she just grabbed my arm. She said, "We got to get out of here."
Now the Guffeys are moving the shop to the south side of town to hopefully escape the flooding.
It's either that or close up.
The Guffey shop sits just inside the floodplain, but right now they don't carry insurance. Most homeowners' insurance policies don't cover flood, so you have to purchase it through the federal government. As of 2 years ago, a little more than 23,000 properties in Indiana were covered under the National Flood Insurance Program. That's less than 1% of households and businesses in the state. James Sink is an insurance liaison for the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA. On a Skype call, he says historically about 20% of flood damage claims would come from outside the floodplain. But that percentage is growing as rain patterns change.
So just because someone doesn't live inside of that special flood hazard area does not mean that they're not at risk for flooding. Low risk does not mean no risk.
So how do people find out if they should buy flood insurance? One way is to look at federal floodplain maps. Unfortunately, those maps are often out of date, especially with the changing climate. David Knipe with the Indiana Department of Natural Resources helps create Indiana floodplain maps for FEMA. He says FEMA is supposed to update its maps every 5 years, but Congress has to approve the funding to do it, so it ends up being more like every 5 to 10. Even if floodplain maps were more current, he says they're only meant to show risks from rivers and streams.
However, there's also risks that aren't mapped with these maps, more localized flooding that you'd see like in a neighborhood if you had a large downpour over a neighborhood.
And Knipe says we're seeing that kind of flooding more often. Take, for example, two neighborhoods outside Columbus. Amanda Burdine and her neighbors in Armith Acres and Northcliff suspect drainage tiles from nearby farm fields are sending water into their homes and yards during heavy rains. This spring, Burdine's home had standing water for more than 30 days.
You have no ability to take showers, wash your clothes, go to the restroom. There were people that had to be taken out of the neighborhood in trucks by family members and didn't come back for 2 or 3 weeks.
After the last flood in 2015, Burdine fixed the damage to her basement, where her two oldest daughters sleep, and bought two pumps to try to keep the water down. It totaled $25,000.
So in January, we paid off that debt,
and we got flooded again in February.
Most Hoosiers qualify for flood insurance, even if they're not in a floodplain. But not everyone can afford it. James Sink with FEMA says the average premium in Indiana is just over $1,000 a year. That's about the same amount the average Hoosier pays for home insurance. Most people who own a home in an area that floods would want both. This leaves residents like Amanda Burdeen feeling stuck.
We just don't know what to do next because we don't know what's going to happen the next time it rains. Do you fix it and cross your fingers? Or do you not fix it and prepare for what will happen again?
David Knipe with the DNR says the agency is working with FEMA to find ways to more quickly update floodplain maps. Until then, residents will have to decide if the peace of mind that comes with flood insurance is worth the cost. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The new governor of Illinois wants to legalize recreational marijuana across the state. Meanwhile, some doctors are already prescribing pot as an alternative to opioids. Side Effects Public Media's Steph White said looks at that program.
Since February, patients in Illinois have been able to swap their opioid prescriptions for marijuana, and many are doing just that.
We have almost 900 patients enrolled in the program now, and over 300 physicians who have created a user account and submitted a physician certification for a patient.
Connie Muller-Moody works on medical cannabis at the Illinois Department of Public Health. The program is open to any patient who has a prescription for opioid medications like OxyContin. The state is still gathering statistics on why patients are participating, but nationwide, chronic pain is the most common reason people turn to medical marijuana, and for some people, pot is more appealing than powerful opioids. Gavin Glass is a student at Southern Illinois University who has suffered from back and nerve pain since he was in high school. He was barely able to get through his classes, he said, and struggled to make it through the day.
I was never actually on any opioids, but they were certainly recommended to me.
He says medical marijuana has made a huge improvement in his life. His joints stopped hurting and he has more energy. But not everyone is sold on the benefits of marijuana, and because the federal government limits research on it, the impact is still uncertain.
The problem is that the medical marijuana is a lot of anecdotal evidence. There's not a lot of true scientific studies out there with double-blind studies or any scientific background whatsoever.
Bill McCreary is a retired pharmacist and member of the Center for Rural Health at Southern Illinois University. He supports the medical marijuana program, and he says opioids carry greater risks than the chemical components of pot.
The long-term effects of opioids are, at this point, we think much more serious than long-term effects of cannabinoids and THC.
Marijuana has fewer side effects and overdoses. In 2017, there were more than 2,000 opioid-related deaths in Illinois. That doesn't mean patients can't overdose on marijuana. They can, though it's extremely unlikely for adults. And even if it happens, it's unlikely to result in death.
With opioids, we know that the neural functioning of the brain is actually altered, and it doesn't come back.
Dr. Peter Grinspoon is a physician in Massachusetts, where medical marijuana has been legal since 2012. He believes it's effective, especially for patients who need lifelong pain management.
Your life is so much better on cannabis, which doesn't take anything away from you, than it is on opiates, which sort of sucks the life out of you.
But Grinspoon also sees a role for regulation, particularly when it comes to how medical marijuana is packaged and sold. He's especially cautious about edibles that can appeal to children who are vulnerable to overdosing.
If marijuana or cannabis is a medicine, then don't put it in something that tastes good. You wouldn't put ibuprofen in a gummy bear. Why would you put cannabis in a gummy bear? A four-year-old kid or a dog wouldn't know the difference, and they'll eat the whole bag.
The Illinois program requires doctors have an existing relationship with the patient requesting marijuana, in part so these concerns can be discussed. For patients like Gavin, it's made a huge difference.
Because I had felt like I had gotten my life back again, and I felt comfortable doing things because I wasn't in pain all the time.
The Alternatives to Opioids program will expire in June of 2020 unless it's extended by the state legislature. Steph Whiteside, Illinois Newsroom.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The 27th annual Letter Carriers Stamp Out Hunger Food Drive is on Saturday, May 11th, and Northwest Indiana post offices are taking part. Merrillville and Gary residents are asked to place non-perishable food items next to their mailbox to do their part in the fight against hunger. Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson spoke to Sam Eaton, the Merrillville-Gary coordinator of this year's drive, and got more details on how people can help.
So tell me about the food drive. Why do the letter carriers do this every year? Because it's been quite a few years, hasn't it?
Actually, we've done this annually for the last 27 years. And basically, just to give you a little history about what we're doing, the Letter Carrier Stamp Out Hunger Food Drive is an outgrowth of a tradition that the community service exhibited by members of the National Association of Letter Carriers for over the last 125 years. Letter carriers, as we walk through our communities every day, often coming face to face with the community, we do see the sad reality of far too many of our customers that are actually going through hunger situations. So each year, on the second Saturday in May, letter carriers across the country collect non-perishable food donations from our customers. And these donations go directly to our local food pantries to provide to the people in those particular neighborhoods and in the surrounding areas with the help to replenish those food pantries or food banks. Now, back in 2018, we collected over 71.5 million pounds of food nationally, feeding an estimated 64 million people over the course of our 26-year history. The food drive has collected well over 1.5 billion pounds of food thanks to the Postal Service Universal Delivery Network that spans the entire nation, including Puerto Rico, Guam, and U.S. Virgin Islands.
Have any idea how those numbers break down here in Merrillville, Gary area?
After each collection period, we actually take the food that was collected and we actually weigh the food. And we do have some figures, and I don't want to share those right now because last year the scales were a little off or what have you, but we do actually weigh the food, and sometimes we're in the neighborhood of 40,000 pounds of food collected in some of these areas that are actually going right back into our neighborhood.
And the timing of the food drive being right now is significant because food pantries are usually depleted from Thanksgiving, Christmas, when they get their big donations?
Absolutely, absolutely. And again, the need for the food donations are great because currently 42 million Americans, that's 1 in 6, are unsure where their next meal is coming from. 16 million are children who feel the hunger impact on their overall health and ability to perform in school. And nearly 5 million seniors over the age of 60 are food insecure. So what that means is the food drive is really crucial for us. So with that said, the food banks and pantries often receive the majority of the donations that we do actually collect. And again, like you mentioned, Thanksgiving and Christmas is usually when the intake or when everyone seems to use the food banks, which actually then diminishes and depletes them at that time. So by the springtime, many pantries are depleted when we're actually entering into the spring and summer months, and those pantries are low on supplies, and that's when, you know, school breakfast and lunch programs are not available, you know, for some of the children that are in need. So by us participating with the Letter Carrier Step Out Hunger Food Drive, it just allows us to help in our local communities supply and replenish those food banks during the summer months. And basically what we're doing, we're just asking all the customers on the letter carrier routes throughout our area just to leave a non-perishable food donation in a bag or even in the actual mailbox itself on Saturday, May the 11th, and your letter carrier will do the rest. So with everybody's help and the help of the U.S. Postal Service, we've collected over, again, 1.67 million pounds of food in the United States over the past 26 years as our national food drive has been in place.
Do you usually get a lot of participation here locally?
We do, we do. And actually, what we're doing this year, we want to sort of reintroduce to the community with support as far as getting the schools involved, some of the precinct committee personnel. Not only that, some of the churches, we're sending information out to the churches so they can spread the word to the congregations to, you know, inform them of the dates as well. And we also have volunteers who will actually come out and assist us with their vehicles to help collect food from various donors, you know, maybe that the postal carrier may not be able to, you know, collect that food, you know, within a certain time parameter. So, yes, we have an outpouring of support coming this year. And it's basically because what we're trying to do this year and the years going forward is actually put in place, you know, some partnerships with local participants in the community so we can make this thing go super successful each year going forward.
Okay, so how can people help out? How can people participate?
Well, the biggest help that we can receive from the community is just that everybody kind of spread the word to each other and just remember to mark on their calendars that on Saturday, May the 11th, just please put a non-perishable food item or a bag of food items around their mailboxes or in their mailboxes. And again, our letter carriers, they're out. We're excited. We're really, truly motivated because not only is this a labor of love, we actually are doing, you know, some good in our neighborhoods, and we really take that truly seriously. Not only are we doing that, but letter carriers, we are sort of the eyes and ears of the communities that we actually service. And, you know, we tend to kind of, you know, keep an eye on some of our elderly people, and if we see things that tend to go awry, we're sort of like that first responder type individual that kind of, you know, help get maybe first responders in on situations that are sort of going awry or whatever.
And where does the food go that you guys collect?
That's a great question. Now, this year, we in the Maryville area, we have it situated where Ross Township, they're going to actually help us collect the food and take it to their food bank. And from there, they actually go ahead and pretty much supply and pass out food to other food pantries in the Maryville area. Now, I do believe in the Gary area, there's a food pantry or food bank by the name of Brother's Keeper. So the food that we collect in that area, we're going to actually get it over to the Brother's Keeper. And again, they're going to actually pass food out to some of the other food pantries and churches that actually have food pantries and kitchens in those areas as well.
Okay. Thanks so much, Sam. I really appreciate it.
I appreciate it, Sheriff. And thank you.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Here's regionally speaking host Chris Nolte with a conversation with Brian Lamb of C-SPAN.
The fellow who is best known for C-SPAN, Brian Lamb, has stepped aside the TV camera, the microphone, at least on a full-time basis now. He's still on occasionally, but he's stepped away from this full-time job that he had. That goes all the way back to the creation of C-SPAN many years ago. And we have Brian Lamb with us on the phone from the C-SPAN headquarters to talk about it. Brian, thank you for joining us here on Regionally Speaking.
Hi, Chris. Glad to be with you.
Thank you very much for joining us today. If you will, first tell us a little bit about how your involvement in broadcasting and what you did in Washington, D.C. led up to the creation of C-SPAN.
Well, I came here in the United States Navy back in 1966, and born and raised in Lafayette, went to Purdue, spent 4 years in the Navy, and I got started in all this by seeing what was going on inside the Pentagon. You know, and I was not an important part of the Pentagon. I was a gopher, but I was a lieutenant junior grade. And that's how I got started in this town.
And what made you think that that C-SPAN would be something important? I know you've had a lot of support over the years about, I guess, taking your idea of getting public affairs on television, and in particular on cable TV, because I know that's how you created C-SPAN, is by your cooperation with all of the cable systems around the country.
I actually didn't think it was going to be necessarily important. I thought it was going to be an interesting possibility to be an alternative for everything else that was on television news. There was no real public affairs. Public television dabbled in it, but on a national basis, they found that in order to keep the money coming in, they had to get away from you know, a lot of that. They weren't anxious to do a lot of hearings. When I started with it, we had no idea where it would go, and it all started because technology changed. The satellite was launched back in 1975 for cable, and they started, HBO was the first one, they started using the satellite, and it just seemed like something that I could suggest to the industry, didn't have any idea if they'd take it, and they you know, it wasn't going to cost much, and a couple of really good guys thought that it would be a good civics opportunity, and that's how it started.
Yeah. How difficult was it to get the chance to see sessions of Congress, either the House and the Senate or both of them, on television, and now did you see them basically full-time?
The House had been talking about it for years, but nobody knew it, and they had a little commission set up behind the scenes. And when I first pitched the idea of something to the cable television industry, it wasn't to cover the House gavel to gavel. They first said, a couple guys first said, yeah, we can fund that. That makes sense, and it wasn't going to cost much. But after they went around and talked to people in the cable industry, they started saying, I don't think that's worth it. I don't see where there's a market for that. And, of course, we never intended it to be a for-profit thing. Then all of a sudden, after they said no the first time around, actually a lot of people said no, The House decided to go on television, and I was right in the mix at that point and found out about it before they made the final decision and made the suggestion that maybe if they decided to put the House on television that the cable people could carry it to the home, and that's how it started. It all just went very fast back in 1977 in October. When it was voted in.
Mm-hmm. Now, how long did it take to get the Senate on cable as well, too?
They were so dead set against the idea, and the old-timers didn't want anything to do with transparency and opening it up. It took till June 2nd of 1986 to go on television.
Wow, more than a decade later, then, it sounds like. Yeah,
yes.
Sure. What, were they just afraid that they didn't want to see people with their shirt tails out or chewing gum or something or smoking on camera?
I don't really know. I think it's a case of where people like the power they have in these institutions, and bringing something in from the outside called television made them nervous. It's the same thing going on right now with the Supreme Court. They're dead set against the idea of going on television, and it'll be a while. And they don't have the same concerns that members of the House and Senate have, which is basically getting voters to vote for them. So it's an interesting thing to watch, the whole idea of opening the process up. There are a lot of people that talk about it, but very few people in positions of power that really want to do it.
Now, being with the C-SPAN concept from the very beginning, and of course going first with members of the House and then the Senate, of course, and other activities of government in Washington, D.C., you started doing conversations about books, talking to authors and the like. What are some of the things that you remember the most? That, in fact, it's only been just a few years ago that you had just quit doing the book reviews and the like here. What do you remember most about talking with the authors?
Well, I started in 1988 with an interview with a guy named Neil Sheehan, who wrote a book, The Bright Shining Lie, which was all about Vietnam, and it was very much anticipated. It took him 16 years to write it. I just got intrigued by the idea after Vietnam, which was such a miserable experience for this country, that Neil Sheehan might be able to shed some really interesting light on why we got in there and what happened. And so I sat down with him for 2.5 hours. We created 5 programs, stripped them across the 8 o'clock hour. And after that, it seemed like what a great, interesting possibility to talk to authors about their hardback nonfiction books. That's what started Book Notes in 1989. I did it for 16 years and decided that, and I had my own rules, that I had to read the book and it had to be a hardback and it had to be nonfiction and it could only be an author on the show once. And I got to the end of 16 years and said, this is taking too much of my time. So I just changed the name, called it Q&A, kept doing it and until right now, and still did a lot of books. So I just stumbled into the whole thing about books, and it's been very important to us.
Now let's go from Book Notes to your book that you have out there available, that you've written not long ago and is available to look at here, about the presidents. Give us an idea first about how you came up with the concept and a little bit about the book.
Actually, when we started Book Notes, we came up with the concept of doing a book very long time ago, over 20 years ago, by taking the author's comments and their narrative and taking my questions out and creating 10-page chapters that reflect what they said in the interviews. And we've done 9 of those books, and this latest book is called The Presidents, and it's 44 chapters. 44 different presidencies. It does not have a chapter. It has a chapter on Donald Trump, but not about whether he was successful or not. It just talks about what the atmospherics were when he got elected. And the idea was to be able to read about something about each president and then when you're interested, dig deeper on your own. Go get the book, go get other books, and just give yourself a good civics education.
I guess you could say, about Donald Trump, that in a word, that the story about him hasn't yet been written. So I guess you can't put that chapter in anyway, could you?
Not even close to being written. And we don't do these surveys of where the presidents stand until after they're out of office.
We're talking with Brian Lamb, who is a native of Lafayette, a graduate of Purdue University, and is the creator of the concept, and later now what we know as C-SPAN, the cable television networks, more than one network, we should say, that deals with public affairs, and a lot of it dealing with official Washington, D.C. And we should say, too, that C-SPAN has an outreach to Indiana still, don't they? They have an operation based in northwest Indiana that kind of helps service C-SPAN in a way, doesn't it?
We have our video archive with 250,000 hours of hearings and everything we've had on the network since 1987, located in West Lafayette, Indiana. It was originally associated with Purdue, but we separated some years ago, and we just kept it in Lafayette, run by a Purdue professor who works for us on a full-time basis, Robert Browning. And anybody in the country, anybody in the world that can access the archive on the internet can watch any program we've done over those last 250,000 hours.
Oh my gosh, 250,000 hours! Hard to believe, to be sure.
I know.
Now, keeping you in Northwest Indiana, in Lafayette in particular, how did growing up in Lafayette and your experiences in Lafayette and West Lafayette there at Purdue seem to shape your life and in turn your career?
A tremendous impact. I went to Purdue. I was a hometown guy. My father was from that area. My mother came out of Arkansas. Lafayette was a very open community. They were very interested in people like me getting to do anything they wanted to do and take a chance. And my first boss at WASK, which you worked at for some years, was Henry Rosenthal, and Henry was a mentor, and I also worked at the local television station. A fellow from Indiana, Dick Shively, was the owner there, and these were very important people to me, including my high school broadcasting teacher. It all came out of that community to give me the chance to do what I've done, which, you know, trust me, I'm very grateful.
Give us some recollections, if you will, about starting out in local broadcasting. We always think of the big city, like in our case, Chicago, or New York, or Los Angeles, or other bigger cities, or smaller cities of that magnitude. What's it like to work in local radio, and what did you happen to remember and kind of bring back some anecdotes about it?
Well, what I've learned since I was in local radio is that national radio is no different. If you're doing what comes naturally, you're trying to pass information on to the public, and it really doesn't feel any different. When I was in Lafayette on that radio station, one day a buddy of mine and I called a guy named Franklin McCormick. He used to do an all-night show on WGN in Chicago. And I remember my question to him was, how does somebody like me, and I think I was 19 at the time, get from Lafayette to having a big-time job like you in Chicago?
Yeah.
And he said, well, if my recommendation is you stay there as long as you can, because what you're learning there is just as significant as what you're going to learn beyond there, and then come to the big city and give that a try later. Lafayette Radio allowed me to interview all kinds of well-known national figures because Purdue would have these entertainers come to campus. One of the first ones I ever interviewed was a man named Nat King Cole, and he was a tremendous personality in those days, and he would entertain at Purdue. He died at age 45. But when he was there, he allowed me to interview him for the local radio station. The Kingston Trio were really a big deal. They came to that area, and I went up to Monticello, Indiana, and sat down and interviewed them. And what I most remember from that interview is that I said after it was over, it was only 15 minutes, I said, let me check the tape. I checked the tape, and it didn't take. And I looked at these three guys, and I said, is there any way we can do this again? Because if I go back to Lafayette without an interview with you, I'm going to get fired. And those guys, Nick Reynolds, Bob Shane, and David Gard, said yes. So I redid the interview, and I went back, and I wasn't a hero, but I certainly wasn't dismissed from the radio station.
Well, at least you got the interview. That's right. It happens like that. Well, those problems happen even today, even in the digital age. And that brings me to my final question to you, Brian, to talk about your views about the changing media landscape, especially here in the internet era.
I love what's happening. I know there's some glitches. I know there's some concern. But people have never had this kind of freedom in the history of the world. And it's so much fun to watch people create their own podcasts. I just saw a headline somewhere, is Bill Clinton going to create his own podcast? Wouldn't surprise me. It's a lot of fun. It doesn't cost much. Nobody controls what you're going to say. If it doesn't work, so what? And there's never been this opportunity like there is now. And I love what's going on. I don't like some of the nasty stuff that we hear, but we started out hearing the nasties when we started our call-in show in October of 1980.
Mm-hmm.
People, when they're anonymous, can say whatever they want to say, and it creates somewhat of this hate atmosphere we have. But I think we've got to have faith that over time this is all going to settle down, and the freedom that people have is extraordinary.
Do you think that maybe with this being the podcast era, that because anybody can do a podcast, you can also say, too, that if you do it right, and do it slickly enough, I suppose, for some, that you can make lots of money from it, I suppose.
I guess. It's never been the kind of thing that drove me to make money. And this is a nonprofit company supported by the cable television business, or we wouldn't be here. But, yes, I hear people talking all the time about doing it for money and doing it with advertisers, and it obviously in several cases it works.
Now, Brian, let me ask just a little question now. That is the last question. If you could do something all over again, what would you do?
Well, it's pretty simple. If I had this to do over again, I would raise more money in the beginning. It caused us to struggle during the early part of the cable business programming getting bigger and bigger. And because of that, we haven't been treated in some cases as well as we could have been if we were in a little bit better financial condition. Having said that, we're in great financial condition during this period right now, and we're going to need it because cable television is losing subscribers to the young kids that aren't interested in they want their their smartphones, and that's what they're number one interested in. And so it's going to give us a cushion, but that's what I would do differently if I could start over again, but I'm not going to be able to.
Well, Brian Lamb, thank you for spending time with us today. We really appreciate the opportunity to talk with not only, a giant of the telecommunications industry and how you've created C-SPAN and how it's become the great public affairs networks of today, but also, too, that you're an Indiana native and that you've been able to show folks back here in Indiana that you can take a simple idea and turn it into something very successful. Thank you for being with us today, Brian.
Thanks, Chris. I always consider myself a Hoosier, no matter how far I get away from it, and it was a great place to grow up.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by bensound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.